Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here again, charged up, ready to go, talking about science. Kevin, I'm stoked to be here. How are you?
I'm doing great. I've been looking forward to this all day so I could get out of putting in a fence in the oppressive heat. So that was my exciting day. 324 feet of fencing.
Nothing sounds more awful than that because it's this week it's been like 109. And yeah. if you don't know what that kind of heat is like consistently, folks, just punch yourself in the forehead a couple times and then give it an hour and then do it again. That's basically what it's like. But it's okay. Yeah. We got AC. We got technology. Technology rocks. We're going to talk about that some today. And with that, Kevin, let's get into our stories. And we've got some good ones. We always have good ones, but I'm especially pumped to talk about these ones. So first up, science-free webinar, Carrie Gillum's latest glyphosate hysteria debunked. Next up, follow the science. Biden administration politicizes EPA by ignoring its own scientists on atrazine. And finally, mind-boggling fruity craft beers produced with GMO yeast finds rapturous reception. I love that word rapturous, Kevin. It just like drunk hipsters just like, oh, GMOs. Okay. Serious. We're serious on this show. First up, Kevin, let's talk about this webinar that we both, I believe you attended. I attended it. And speaking of punching myself in the head, I wanted to do that as I was watching this. So what are we talking about?
I tried to attend. I got double booked on two Zoom calls. So I watched out of one eye and then talked on the other. And but I was able to record it and listen to it later and put myself to sleep with it that night. The bottom line is this was supposed to be a big discussion about atrazine, or sorry, atrazine, that's coming up, glyphosate, and it featured some interesting folks. It was Carrie Gillum, who was the person who sells books about this and worked for USRTK and was paid by the industries that don't like vaccination or genetic engineering. And then Cory Booker, Senator Booker, was on there, a guy who I can align with on some things, but turns out he's out of his mind on glyphosate. And then a couple other folks, one who is the self-ordained glyphosate girl, who was rather interesting, and then two others that really didn't talk much about glyphosate at all. So the whole thing was really a snooze fest for me. I was kind of hoping for some folks to start lobbing some bombs and then be able to do a short webinar to talk about how we would debunk that stuff. But it didn't really bunk itself. So there was there was very little debunking to do. It was kind of more of a non-expert, here's what I think kind of thing, rather than a discussion of evidence. And then a discussion of, the need to be in the regenerative agriculture with no one defining exactly what that means. So it was a very, it was really disappointing because I was really hoping to see something that we'd be able to work with and understand where they're coming from. But it really was a big zero burger.
I like that term, by the way. When you retweeted my article about this, you used that phrase and it's it's great, man. What got to me about it, you're right. They didn't really make a lot of ridiculous statements. They just sort of took those for granted. So I remember Carrie at the beginning and then the glyphosate girl, they both in passing were like, well, we know there's all this evidence that implicates glyphosate as a cause of serious disease and the research is being suppressed. So anyway, let's talk about, they just kind of set the premise as all of this stuff we know is not true. And then they moved on from that. I did find that interesting, but the biggest takeaway, and you alluded to this on Twitter as well, but my biggest takeaway was just the stunning level of hubris that was on display during this discussion. And the comment I made in my story was that it was so thick you could have poured it on pancakes. It's just, you have six people only one of them who has any relationship to agriculture at all talking about how they're going to remake the global food system. It's just, it's a level of foolishness and self-righteousness that I can't even fathom, really. So what are your thoughts on there? Let's start with that.
Well, I think it was just kind of, and that's what was so sad about it. It was essentially folks who, you know, the last two who spoke, and I can't remember his name or her name. They were two people who I don't necessarily disagree with. I mean, there's got to be interesting ways that we could try in innovative ways to increase farm productivity, and you know, God bless them, you know, good trying other stuff, whatever it takes. If the ideas you propose as what you're calling regenerative or whatever, if it works, farmers will use it. That's great. No problem. Do what you got. The problem is vilification of good chemistry, and glyphosate being a chemical that's been around for 40 some years now and has been through exhaustive regulation and trials and tons of scrutiny, and turns out to be a pretty decent compound in terms of its toxicity. Very low toxicity, doesn't really do much. But if you listen to Glyphosate Girl, it's the end of the world. She was rather interesting. So she, you know, is having all kinds of health problems and went to the doctor, and turns out she's deficient in every vitamin under the sun. And then says, oh, it must be the glyphosate. So that seemed to be kind of a strange conclusion. And I found hers to be the least compelling and the most conspiratorial talk of the bunch. But Senator Booker was really disappointing because he kept saying these toxic herbicides, these toxic chemicals, these dangerous chemicals. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And is he married to Rosario Dawson?
I have no idea. And
I think the main squeeze is a kook. And so I think that's where it comes from. Cause she's the one who like funded all those really boring documentaries about, you know, Love the Dirt or whatever it was called. I mean, I watch them all. I watch all this stuff, but it's so uninspiring and just so boring and just like, come on. And, but I think when he goes home, she might be invoking a little bit of hysteria. And the sad part is that a guy like Booker, who seems to have it right with respect to climate change and other stuff, he loses all of his gravitas in those arenas if he's going to start making up stuff because his wife thinks so. And I think that's a really, and that's something else we can talk about too, but I'm going to fire off a letter to him, see if we can, you know, maybe I can get an audience with him and help him out a touch. But it really was a pretty limited set of takeaways from this set of talks.
It reminded me a lot of like a Jennifer Aniston rom-com. You just knew every single part of the movie before you watch it. Everything's predictable. Everything is polished and everything's there to do a specific action that you know is coming in advance. So it was boring in that sense. By the way, the two people whose names escaped you were Calla Rose Ostrander. She's a political economist, and Matt Nicoletti. I think he's the head of business development at Penny Newman Grain Company. And there you go. As you said, they were interesting. And for Ostrander, she seems like she's down the glyphosate Kool-Aid. But she made an interesting point in that she said, well, our organization, I think it was Farmers Footprint or something, whatever, the organization she's affiliated with, they focus on soil health. And she said strategically that was because nobody's going to oppose soil health. So mm-hmm. She said, we've kind of flown under the radar and no one's attacked us. And my first thought was like, well, yeah, duh, because we all agree that we need healthy soil to grow food. No one's against that. And I thought that was very revealing in that she thought that was sort of a secret jujitsu debate move. But it just underscores, it's like no farmer wants to deplete the soil that they depend on for their livelihood, right? I mean, no, we're all on board with that. And Matt Nicoletti, I'm not familiar with him at all, but I thought he was interesting because his role in the whole thing seemed to be, well, I'm the guy that works in ag and I sort of legitimize the rest of these people's wild theories because I know about fertilizers and I work with farmers. That seemed to be the role he played. But I noticed that he went out of his way to say, you know, I don't deal with the crop protection side of things. I don't talk about glyphosate. My job is to help farmers, you know, farm more sustainably. And I try to get them using low salt fertilizers. And basically he was saying, I promote sustainable agriculture, to which again, I say, duh, that's what we're all interested in. So it, like, the two folks who had the most legitimate insights agreed with us. That was what I found so interesting about that.
Yeah, his stuff about, you know, salt fertilizers, that kind of raised a little cockles on my behalf. But, you know, we're leaving out the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that was Zach Bush. And when he's wackier. I can't even think of it, the metaphor or the simile. He was like off the rails when he goes out there and has, again, hubris of, well, we know from my laboratory that it affects tight junctions, and this happens in the digestive tract and happens there, and everything we look at shows this. He hasn't published his data. He doesn't show data. He's not somebody who's putting this into peer review. And what he's probably doing is has some kind of Hackney in vitro assay that shows, you know, some effect on something. But if it's glyphosate or if it's Roundup, it isn't clear. And yeah, if you put Roundup, which is a surfactant, on cells, you're going to see sufficient changes in cellular membranes, probably tight junctions. You're going to see a lot of things happen. The surfactants, just for those listening, these are the chemicals that are added to herbicides to help them pass through membranes. And so they are typically like detergents. You can think of them like that, that they help things move through cells. So when you look at, for instance, there's a lot of good examples. You can use these neat little bubbles, basically, to help an encapsulated compound move into a cell or open up a little channel where it can move through. So, yeah, I don't think you're going to see glyphosate formulations treating cells very well in culture. If you put distilled water into tissue culture cells, animal cells, you put in a drop of Windex, you put in a little bit of sugar, you put in some salt, you put in whatever. These are extremely fragile systems that can be good for generating an initial hypothesis, but aren't terribly valuable in telling you much about long-term toxicity that you have to assess in vivo. And to what I can tell, he hasn't done any of that stuff. So, but yeah, he was like, I didn't like the guy before, and now I think he's really downright dangerous. He's in the same category as Stephanie Seneff, because he's got a little bit of training and a little bit of gravity and a little bit, and he's got some credentials, and that makes him especially dangerous at spreading bad information.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think the MD behind his name, or next to his name, I think it fools people, because it gives the perception of expertise that actually may not be there. Don't get me wrong. Physicians are highly intelligent people, and they obviously do invaluable work in keeping people healthy and treating sick individuals and so forth. But being an MD, it doesn't make you an expert in toxicology or pesticide chemistry or even epidemiology. It certainly doesn't give you an insight into soil health or, you know, the mechanism by which a pesticide might cause cancer. I mean, the experts who would know those topics work in highly specialized fields. And so we've mentioned Liza Dunn on this show, she's a physician as well, but she's a toxicologist. So if they were to have someone like her involved in that conversation, things would have gone very differently. But as I said, I think Bush's role there was to say, I'm the smart guy with the medical degree and you can trust what I say. And I think it was, Dr. Mary Mangan, a good friend of the show and our mutual friend on Twitter, who said, I went and looked up, you know, I went to PubMed, I went to all the research databases I normally go to, I couldn't find a single study he'd publish. So I don't know if maybe he really thinks he has done this work or he's being dishonest. I don't know, but it's just fascinating that he would make a comment like that in passing. And then, as you said, these studies are preliminary if they're reliable at all. And the other thing is that you're working with immortalized cell lines. So they're either cancerous cells or they're cells that you have to deliberately damage so they keep dividing so you can run your experiment on them. So even if you find something wrong with the cells at the end of your experiment, it may not be that it's the chemical that did it. It's just, you have to be very careful with this sort of research is all.
Yeah, well, and he acts like he's the pioneer in dumping herbicides on cells. You know, there's been people doing this for 45 years, and then, you know, Seralini did it, you know, in whenever that was, 2009, a paper from Seralini's lab, where they dumped it onto Leydig cells, which are testicular cells, and show it does absolutely nothing, except at the lowest concentration, there was a little bit of a blip. And they said, here's the basis for world infertility.
When you add more, the infertility problem goes away. So just
that's right. It's only at the lowest concentration, though.
Yeah.
And you know, believe me, you know, I beat my brains out about this stuff. The bottom line is that you have these kinds of get togethers. And I don't know how many people were online, but I think it was pretty substantial. And a couple hundred. And they all left with this idea that this is a dangerous compound that's going to, you know, destroy the universe. And yet it really collides with what we know from science. And I think we need to be doing more with countering these types of things with more informative science-based webinars. And I think I was kind of hoping to do it that night, just spur of the moment, but it's like there's nothing to counter. But we should do it going forward and maybe something we should watch.
I'm down to do that anytime. Let's coordinate and we can turn it into an episode. Before we move on, I want to make a few comments about Kelly Ryerson, who is the self-described glyphosate girl. I honestly...
Worst superhero ever.
And I don't want to... I want to try to avoid sound condescending here. I'm probably going to fail, but nonetheless, there's the qualifier. I sort of felt bad for her as she was talking because... I don't know her medical history. I never will. It's none of my business. But as she's talking, I got the impression that she really does or has had some serious medical conditions in the past that were hard to treat. And for whatever reason, her doctors couldn't figure out what it was or what those conditions were. And she was looking for answers, right? She was doing her homework and trying to figure out what's causing all these symptoms. And then she unfortunately landed on Zach Bush and Carrie Gillum's work. And so she's sort, you know what I mean? Because I could imagine being in a position where something tragic happens to you and you're just trying to make sense of what happened and, you know, why am I going through this? And I think just like with the anti-vax stuff, the glyphosate narrative that people like Carrie and Zach Bush have cooked up, it gives people the answer they're looking for. Well, you see, there's this corrupt evil corporation, right? And they've bought off the EPA, right? And now they bury all the studies that prove that their chemical's dangerous, right? And that's why you're sick. You know, like it gives people exactly what they need. And so I was trying to sympathize with her as she was speaking. And then she walked into my crosshairs because she said, well, the American Council on Science and Health is a Monsanto front group, and so is the Genetic Literacy Project, both organizations of which I've worked for and been affiliated with, and the show is affiliated with. And so right there, I sort of lost my sympathy, and I was like, look, we defend pesticides when the evidence shows that they're low risk and that they can be used safely by farmers. That's all we do. When it comes to this issue, that's all we do. We just look at the data and we say, there's nothing to be scared of here, folks. Sorry if that ruins your business model or ruins your scare party. And I don't care that much after that. So it was just funny for her to say like, oh yeah, these groups were set up in the basement of Monsanto to go forth and defend their products. It's just so absurd. Like people don't understand how nonprofits work. They don't understand how this sort of work actually functions that we do. And I just wanted to get that out of the way. So. What other thoughts do you have?
Well, I guess that's kind of it. I agree with you, and I feel bad for folks who have kind of chronic illness or a bunch of unusual illnesses, and it really is a bummer when they land on the non-cause, because the problem is it means they didn't solve the problem, and that, you know, the real root of the issue hasn't been resolved. And so, you know, it's something that I always feel super bad about, like when they start talking about vaccines and autism, or, you know, glyphosate and autism. You know, when you start making those kinds of proclamations, you now divert our attention from what are the real causes and our attention in the sorting out what might really be happening. And that really is a disservice to those who are affected.
One final thought before we move on. I think there were a few thousand people, and I was trying to get a question submitted, but there were just probably more than 100 questions constantly coming in, and they got kookier and kookier as the event went on. And at one point towards the end, I saw Kerry Gillum look over at the chat and go, "Oh, wow, we've got a lot of questions in here. Okay, so everyone, thank you for joining us. Let's you know," and I'll never be able to prove this. She won't ever talk to me. She's blocked us on Twitter. But I distinctly got the impression that she saw people going and talk about how Pfizer's vaccine has a chip in it and they're trying to control the world and reduce the population by 50%. I just think she saw that, went, okay, it's time to, we're going to pull the plug on this. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it. You know, let's go fight the power back to our lives. You know, I thought that was hilarious. Okay. Sorry, Kevin. I'm getting a little feisty. Anyways, what's atrazine? You know, if we've never heard of this before.
Oh, yeah. Well, atrazine is neat stuff. It's been around since the 50s. And atrazine is a really, really useful herbicide because it's somewhat selective. It seems to control things like broadleaf plants and some grasses pretty well. So it only works on certain plants. And basically, you know, if you want to know the gross details, it's a photosynthesis inhibitor, and it changes the way that that electron transport happens in photosynthesis. And we can go in all the gross detail about how it affects the, you know, D1 subunit of photosystem 2 and the plastoquinone binding site and all that stuff. And we can go it, but bottom line is we know exactly how it works in the plant. And some plants like corn have a really good ability to degrade it. So corn detoxifies atrazine. Other plants don't. So broadleaf plants can't do it. Really, wheat can't do it. So most plants are not very good with this, but corn is great at breaking it down. So why is this cool? Well, this is good stuff because for years, atrazine was the go-to herbicide in growing corn before glyphosate and genetic engineering. Because you could plant a field of corn, you could go over it with atrazine and you could kill all the weeds and most of the other grasses, and corn would grow and shade them all out. And now you got a big field of corn. Great stuff. And it's relatively safe. It has moderate to low toxicity in any kind of the studies that you look at. Atrazine, maybe, you know, like if you look at the whole slate of acute and dermal and all that stuff, it's really, really safe stuff, relatively safe stuff. So the problem with atrazine is when it gets into water, and there's been a lot of discussion and controversy of this over the years, and Tyrone Hayes was all over atrazine. The big deal with atrazine is that there are some effects in aquatic environments, and you can see this with microbial effects, effects on microbes and, you know, the plankton and that kind of stuff. So it came time to re-register this stuff, and like all herbicides, there are cyclical re-registrations, which means the EPA and the other organizations, FDA, that look at this stuff, they take a look at it again and look at all the new data that came out since the last registration when it was approved. And what they found out was that, at least in the current slate of things, which really started to unfold during the Obama administration and went through the Trump administration, they basically said, well, we're going to change the level that's allowed in aquatic environments. And they switched this around between, bounced around between 10 and 15 parts per billion, which is really low, 10 or 15 seconds in 32 years. And at levels which really haven't been showing any kinds of effects in aquatic environments or in any kind of chronic exposure in animals. There's been loads of stuff done on atrazine, but all of the negative effects are much higher levels. So now the Biden administration has gone around the EPA and their scientists who said, here's what we think, which they recommend, you know, everybody's recommending this 10 to 15 range. And now they've said, well, we need to have it down to 3.4 parts per billion. And so the problem here is that you've now created a standard that can't be met, and that farmers using atrazine, you know, you're going to have some of this make its way in the water, you know, 15 seconds in 32 years, just a tiny little smidge of stuff. And yet, now they're going to change this so that farmers can't use as much as they need to use. And atrazine usually isn't used on genetically engineered corn. That's glyphosate. So if we lose glyphosate, which many people are bucking for, atrazine is the next one in line. So this has a lot of interesting edges to it.
I'm looking at the EPA's most recent review of it as it pertains to health risks. And they say very clearly, this is on page 11, if you guys want to look it up on the EPA's website, but they say there are no dietary residual handler, non-occupational spray drift, or occupational post-application risk estimates of concern for the registered uses of atrazine. So in so many words, and there are thousands of words in this review if you want to go read it and put yourself to sleep, they're more or less saying when used appropriately, this doesn't cause harm. There are a few exceptions. They said, for example, if you spray atrazine on turf, don't let toddlers between the ages of 1 and 2 crawl on it. And I think that's a no duh, right? I think most people understand that. But looking at this document, I can't see anything that's particularly harmful. So what this clearly signals to me, and as you said at the beginning, this isn't a Republican versus Democrat thing because the review process was ongoing, first under Obama and then Trump, and now it's being interfered with under the Biden administration. So it's political, but it's not political in the partisan sense that people are used to. And I think the author of the story, Hank Campbell, who's writing in the Washington Examiner, I don't know if you mentioned that or not, but he says... here it is. He says, this is not the usual Democrats versus Republicans maneuvering. This is the Biden administration versus everybody. Perfect summary of what's going on here. I don't know if it's certain activist groups who have leaned on the Biden administration. Kevin, maybe you have some insight, but it's clear that this isn't a science-based activity that we're dealing with right now.
Well, maybe it was Cory Booker. The pillow talk is getting all the herbicides out of everything. But it is a good example of a what is likely, you know, and this is how it works in Washington is you get some people who have connections with the staffers who can, you know, push something through, lobbyists and that kind of thing. The thing they accuse, you know, us of being lobbyists for Big Ag, which is insanely laughable. The funny part about atrazine is that even the IARC, okay, the ones who said glyphosate is a probable carcinogen, they said there's zero evidence of atrazine being carcinogenic. So even IARC, the ones who say like night shift work, pickled vegetables, and being in a hair salon is bad stuff. They go, okay, atrazine, cool. Hey, have at it, you know? And so this is, it's an interesting angle on this. The thing that we don't think about, and this is pretty important and just for what it's worth, atrazine does have a very, the one thing about atrazine, and why I always mention aquatic environments, and I don't know this intimately, I'm just kind of spitballing a bit here, is that it does last a long time in aquatic environments, and that if you get it into water, it's there for a long time, well over a year. Sunshine, oxygen, that kind of stuff break it down. But it is something that is a legitimate threat to aquatic environments. So it's good to, and it's a restricted use chemical that you have to have special training to use around aquatic environments. So, you know, that's something that should be said. At the same time, here's another interesting angle, and this is really important. One of the downsides of glyphosate is that over the last, 25 years of its use, we've selected a large number of glyphosate-resistant weeds, and the numbers gets bigger every year. There's all kinds of weeds that just grow through the herbicide because weeds evolve very quickly. And it's made farmers say, well, maybe this stuff isn't working for us. The GMO corn isn't as good as it used to be because we can't control the weeds like we used to. Well, some farmers are switching to rotation with atrazine. So you can buy the cheap seeds, just good hybrid corn, not glyphosate tolerant, and then use atrazine, which controls the glyphosate resistant weeds like pigweed. So you can control these things with atrazine that grow through glyphosate. So now you have rotation between these two different mechanisms of two different modes of action, two completely different herbicides, And now you've got people who basically want to make it impossible to get either one. So what are we going to do in a world where we can't grow corn? you know, meat, milk, eggs prices, or meat and milk prices will go up huge. And any kind of thing that uses any kind of processed corn products. So any of your processed foods that use the starches and high fructose corn syrup and all that stuff, prices are going to go through the roof. Basically, this whole effect, this whole thing on atrazine is another landing spot of this big push on chemophobia, where we're seeing groups working with Washington to remove the tools that farmers need. And it's really, really a sad situation.
Well, people's lives are on the line, quite literally. And if you need evidence of that, just look at what happened in Sri Lanka recently. You know, they forced a pesticide and fertilizer ban on farmers, not like 95% of whom needed these chemicals to farm. And this was cheerled by Vandana Shiva and other folks in the regenerative agriculture movement. And right, one third of their land just laid dormant. They couldn't grow anything. So there were massive food shortages, prices spiked, and there was mass suffering to the point that people burned down the prime minister's house. And then they jumped the fence into the president's backyard and they said, "We're going to swim into your pool until you resign because you suck." So if you think that we're just exaggerating here, you know, we're not. There are real consequences. So when it happens in Sri Lanka or it happens in some impoverished country somewhere, it's pretty easy to shrug it off. But when it starts to happen in the European Union or even here, because we're intentionally disrupting how farmers grow our food, and there's wars disrupting the supply chain that the global economy relies on, pretty soon your bread's more expensive, and pretty soon there's bare spots on your grocery store shelves. So this matters, people. This isn't just an academic argument. You have really, really foolish, dangerous people making life harder at a time when there's war, there's inflation. I mean, this is the time you need technology to bolster the food supply and keep it sturdy and keep it steady so we can all eat. And these dummies, like at this webinar we were just talking about, they do not care about your well-being because they are pushing this when we need technologies like this the most.
Well, and they'll be the first ones in line when there is shortages. They'll be well-fed. And this will affect the poor and the food insecure the hardest. And that's what breaks my heart about this, is that here you have these forces that will be affecting agricultural production, harming farmers, harming the environment more, because we're going to switch to dicamba and 2,4-D, which are, you know, old school herbicides, taking tools away from farmers. It's going to raise prices for consumers. And, you know, I'll be okay. But I really, really, heart goes out to the folks who are living on the edge, because they're the ones who aren't going to be able to afford, especially things like, you know, meat and milk and that kind of stuff. I mean, the majority of these crops goes in the cattle feed, and it's not the sweet corn on the cob that you get. It's cattle feed, 90 or probably 80%, and then another 10% in the ethanol. So it's going to hit people at the grocery store and the gas pump. And you know, that's something that I think we got to keep in mind. This is not about, and this is another important point. What we've seen is that we've seen a shift. It's not about a march against Monsanto anymore. This is a march against American farming. And this is a march or modern farming. So it's happening in the EU too, in Australia. And you're seeing groups that are now working to remove the tools from farmers' hands. Groups of well-fed folks who think they're doing the right thing. And I think this is the most alarming, because the thing is, they're wearing out our politicians. I mean, you got Cory Booker saying these things are dangerous. They're not. And now you've got the Biden administration saying we're going to drop the tolerance in water to a level that it can't be. And we're talking about farmers that are spraying, you know, 2 quarts of this stuff over an acre. I mean, it's barely there. And now they're going to have to cut it down to less than barely there. So it's a really scary time.
Preposterous. I'll tell you what, Kerry Gillam, Glyphosate Girl, Cory Booker, all you folks, you start eating the bugs first, okay? You eat the mealworms, you know, you get your protein out of the dirt like that, and then I'm going to feed my son the stuff that's more nutritious and healthy. Because I'm not going to eat bugs. Kevin, I'm going to need some chickens and turkeys in the future, possibly. So put some aside for me.
I know. I want to build a concrete wall around my compound. Yeah. I got to go like total like kook nutball here to protect my own.
Kevin's going full prepper to protect his poultry.
That's right. Anyways. Let's talk about beer.
Yeah, not to belabor it. Let's talk about fruity beers with GMOs in them.
Yeah, cool story by Esther Mobley in the San Francisco Chronicle, July 19th, 2022. And she talks about Berkeley yeast. And Berkeley yeast is this company that creates genetically engineered yeast. So as you're drinking beer, you're using genetically engineered yeast to change the profiles of the different compounds that change the flavors of beer. And those of you who, you know, follow beer, you know that there's been just an explosion of different types and flavors. And whether you're talking about sours or IPAs or whatever, there's so many different things that are available. Berkeley yeast has done, you know, I should have done this. I mean, I knew all this stuff. I should have been the first on this bandwagon. They've engineered yeast to take away the off flavors that occur inside some beers. And they've also engineered yeast to produce other flavors that are actually enhancing the flavors of beer. So if you've had guava cart or any of these, you know, guava flavored beers, they actually produce, and I work a bit in flavor chemistry, so I know how these things fly. They make something called 3-mercaptohexane-1-ol. That's a dominant flavor in guava. And you can make yeast produce it by just putting in an enzyme tweak or two that takes something called glutathione, which is kind of ubiquitous, and does a couple of transformations to make this thing into the guava flavor. And so this company has been engineering yeast, probably using gene editing and then what they call homologous recombination, to introduce the enzymes into beer to create these new flavors and remove the dud flavors, which, you know, when you make any kind of fermentation, you also can produce compounds that are unfavorable. So really good stuff by this company.
There's just one quote I want to mention in passing, and it's a gentleman named Jeremy Roop, who runs R&D and strategy for this company. He says, initial versions of Tropics, that's the yeast they're talking about, express not only the passion fruit and guava notes, but also, quote, smelled like poop. Yeah. They indole. Had to get rid of that.
Yeah. Indole, when you produce indole, it okay. Kind of, yeah, it's the dominant flavor in fart spray.
Well, everyone's got that on their shelf, I'm sure.
Well, I got a bottle of it at the lab. And, you know, it's kind of fun to get that out now and then. Because there's, well, we take kids through all the time and we go through all the different bottles of the different key flavors and aromas from the different fruits and vegetables and things. And I'll pass that one around and, you know, pull the finger at the same time. Good times.
I'm glad I didn't have access to that when I was 12, because that would have been dangerous.
Oh yeah. No, it's great when you want to clear out a room. This place is, you know, I'd love to have a drink here, but it's a little busy. You know,
sorry, sir. There's a 40-minute wait. No, there ain't.
Yeah, it's certainly a way to move up on the list. We'll open the sewer in this place. I know, it's just a 1-milliliter Eppendorf tube full of indole, released at exactly the right place on a strategically placed piece of Kleenex, volatilizes and clears the room. Awesome stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. But not in beer.
Enough fart jokes, because I could seriously make jokes like that for an hour as I
go. I know. And we've been going there a little too much lately.
I know.
But the thing that's good about what they're doing is this is the tip of the iceberg. You're looking at a whole plethora of new ability to remove the off flavors and increase the positive flavors that are associated with alcohol. One big one is there are compounds that called diacetyl. Diacetyl is something that is the major aroma of microwave popcorn, like that weird buttery smell. It's also present in high amounts in things like Chardonnays that have this high amount of butteriness to them. And yet when you put it in an IPA, it actually is an off flavor. And diacetyl, there's ways that you can, you know, warm the culture, the fermenter to get rid of it. There's ways that they can do it with management, or you can use a yeast strain that actually breaks it down. So really, really cool ideas here to make your beverages taste better. And I think it's super exciting.
It's very exciting. And there's something that makes it even more exciting. And that's where this is actually taking place. San Francisco, this region of Northern California, is like the Twilight Zone. If you're not from California, if you've never spent time out here, San Francisco is a goofy place, man. Like if you go there, there's a 95% chance you'll see a few things. You'll see people pooping on the street. You'll see people using heroin in the outside in the open air. You'll see drum circles. I guarantee you there will be at least one drum circle somewhere in the city. But there's also a very, very intense anti-science culture. You know, there's a lot of wealthy people in Marin County, which is part of the San Francisco area. A lot of rich people there who are anti-vax and anti-GMO. Of course, Whole Foods has a big following. Like this is the epicenter of a lot of really goofy, foolish ideas. So the fact that you have companies using modern biotechnology to make beer that people love is a great sneak attack. It's a great end run around people's defenses against this sort of technology. And they talk about in the story how people love it, right? Because it's delicious. It's just really good beer, and it's got all these interesting flavors, and it just opens up a whole new market segment, and it gives people more options as consumers. And so they quoted the non-GMO project, and they tried to gin up a little concern in the story, Kevin. Maybe we can talk about that in a minute. But just in general, this is great because they're applying the technology in a way that enhances people's daily lives, really, especially if they're beer lovers. So this is like the first domino is knocked down in an important way here.
Yeah, I wish they would have done this a long time ago. That's the mistake that Monsanto and others made, was they should have started with beer.
Could you imagine a bunch of drunk guys in 1998 in the March Against Monsanto protest? They're ruining our beer. This is bad.
No, it would have been a stagger for Monsanto. I think it would have been the opposite. I don't think that you would have had many marches against. I think we could have got this whole craft beer thing moving a little bit faster.
Monsanto is awesome. It's ridiculous. Okay, see, we did it again. We did. At least it wasn't about poop. That's a good start. Okay. Something else that's interesting about this, Kevin, I already mentioned the non-GMO angle. I don't know if it's just the journalist, the author of the story trying to say, well, there are some people concerned about it, and they just made the typical, whoever they quoted, I forget who it was, but they just made the typical point. We need stricter regulation. We need labeling, you know, long-term consequences could be dire, blah, 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 blah. But it seems like that's not really taking it. At least that's what I got from the story, is that they sort of felt obligated to throw that in there in the middle of the story. But the ending is, you know, this is just the beginning of more good things to come. So that's encouraging, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it needs to be said, you know, this is technology and we're putting in new genes. The thing that it really underscores is we know exactly what we're doing. And, you know, the folks at Berkeley Yeast are producing a product that they can put in A and B and get out C and D, and it's exactly as predicted. Nothing funny. And just shows that the technology works.
Welcome to 30 years ago, everybody. The technology works. Told you so. Okay. Kevin, who are you following on Twitter?
Yeah, so this is a really cool one. And I want to mention it just because they are on Talking Biotech this week. And this is a company called Genoscopy. And genoscopy is really important because colorectal cancer is the third leading cause of cancer deaths in the U.S. and in the industrialized world. And it's because people don't go get colonoscopies. They feel it's invasive and it's, you know, kind of, you know, butt stuff, whatever. But genoscopy has a very sensitive assay that they use on a stool. And here we go back to poop, right? They use on a stool, and they can detect the earliest stages of colon cancer, of the neoplasias that occur during progression to colon cancer. So this is amazing stuff. Home test, sensitive, fast, and cheap. And the interview I did this week with Erica Barnell, Dr. Barnell, was amazing. And it's really an exciting technology. You can follow them at Genoscopy. What about you?
I would like people to follow an economist named Thomas Sowell. I've mentioned his work multiple times on this show. Very helpful, very insightful. He's written all sorts of books. He's not technically on Twitter because he's like 87. So there's someone tweeting under his name, but they're just quotes from his books. And maybe that'll be your gateway into reading his stuff. But here's one of the quotes he says, and I forget what book this is from, but he says, "Much of the social history of the Western world over the past three decades has been a history of replacing what worked with what sounded good." I feel like that perfectly sums up what we're talking about here with food and farming is, you know, we have technologies that work. Now we're replacing them with these feel-good, holistic principles, and we have this picture of red barns in our head and all natural food, and it means people going hungry. So follow Thomas Sowell. I think he'll help you think more critically and see through silly ideas that you see in the headlines. It's just at Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L. You can follow us as well at ACSH.org for my writing, at Kevin Folta on Twitter. Follow Genetic Literacy Project at Genetic Literacy on Twitter, geneticliteracyproject.org. They make this all possible. Thank you to everybody for listening as always. Your questions and your reviews, we're getting those. They make a difference. We love talking to you and we love your feedback. So thank you so much, and we will see you next week.